The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week,
what will our society be like if for the first time in history most people are beyond middle age or middle-aged and beyond? It's going to be a very different kind of society. I don't think we really know the answer to that.
As we hit the 7 billion figure, the human population is at the centre of several scientific, social and environmental debates. I'll be joined by journalist and author Fred Pearce to discuss how we got to this point and where the future lies for human population. And
the two messages I guess I want to give you, although I'm not sure if I'll get them both covered, is that first, you are much more insignificant than you thought. And secondly, that the universe is, the future is miserable.
We have the first part of a lecture guaranteed to make you feel insignificant in the universe. Professor Lawrence Krauss talks cosmology and our place in it, all 7 billion of us. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. We begin with the startling fact that at present the Earth is home to 70 billion toes, give or take a few unfortunates, which belong, of course, to the 7 billion humans that now inhabit this planet. I'm joined by the owner of 10 of those toes, the environment journalist and author Fred Pearce. Welcome to the programme, Fred.
Pleasure.
And welcome to your toes as well. I hope you have 10, otherwise
I still have 10.
It's embarrassing for us. Well, population has been on the rise for most of the 20th century and will keep rising for some time to come, according to the United Nations. At 7 billion people, it's a good time to take stock. Now, Fred's going to help us analyse some of the issues, and we'll also hear contributions from David Coleman, a professor of demography at Oxford University, and Timothy Dyson, a professor of population studies at the London School of Economics. Let's start with the scientific breakthrough that industrialised agriculture and changed the scale of food production. This was one of the fuels of the population explosion and increased the yields that farmers grew around the world. Here's Timothy Dyson on something called the Haber-Bosch process.
The Haber-Bosch process was developed really early in the 20th century and then really took off in a large scale in after the Second World War. And what the process does is enable the production of synthetic nitrogen fertilizers. Today, the world's population is highly dependent upon these fertilizers for its food supply. It varies from area to area. Some parts of the world are less dependent upon nitrogen fertilizers than others, but particularly heavily populated countries, say China or Egypt or Vietnam or much of India, are highly dependent upon these fertilizers. Without them, they would be unable to feed their populations. So without the Haber-Bosch process for the synthesis of ammonia, the world would be, I would suggest, almost as different as if we were not to have the wheel.
Professor Timothy Dyson there on the Haber-Bosch process. Fred, how important has agricultural technology been to bringing us to the 7 billion people mark?
Absolutely critical, I think. Some estimates are that half the world's population could not be fed without the Haber-Bosch process. In other words, it's allowed us to go from 3.5 billion people, the number of people we had about in the mid-20th century, up to the 7 billion today. So absolutely critical. And at every stage in history, I think population growth has gone with technological innovation, whether it was moving from hunter-gatherers to agriculture or the Industrial Revolution or the Haber-Bosch process and no doubt other things coming up.
Well, one of the other big ones is the dwarf wheat, for example. The idea that you would be able, Norman Borlaug won his Nobel Prize for this, which is the shortening the stems of wheat so that they don't fall over when you grow them. And this revolutionised agriculture all over the world, and again increased populations.
The Haber-Bosch process and those new wheat varieties really went together. That was the core of the Green Revolution, which doubled the amount of food that the world world could produce during the second half of the 20th century.
A different type of green revolution to the one also going on at the 60s, which was all about saving the planet. This was actually consuming more of it.
Well, that's true, yes.
We can come to those issues.
We're always on that kind of hamster wheel. We have to keep the technology going fast enough to keep up with the damage that we're doing.
Yeah, and technology is also the reason why this sort of the problems sort of enthused by your prophet of doom of choice, Thomas Malthus, why none of his predictions came true.
Well, the Haber-Bosch process is one very good reason why Malthus's predictions haven't come true, at any rate yet.
And he was worried about the fact that the population would grow so high that we wouldn't have anything to eat and we'd all have miserable lives.
That's right. Thomas Malthus, who was writing 200 years ago, was the first to propose the idea that basically populations would carry on and on and on growing almost inevitably until they were hit by some disaster, either massive famine or disease. And that remains kind of the view of many environmentalists today. So when Paul Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb, inventing that phrase, the population bomb, back in the late 1960s, really the same kind of story, telling us that as population grew, we would not be able to feed ourselves and that there would be a crash and, you know, a huge catastrophe. Now, we haven't had the catastrophe yet, though you can never say never.
Okay, well, another important factor in the regulation of population has been the oral contraceptive pill for women. This became widely available in the 1960s, and you'd have thought it would have provided a break on population growth. Not quite, says Professor David Coleman.
The effect of the birth control pill on the birth rate is controversial. It probably had a greater effect on the liberation of people's sexual behavior and the way in which sexual passion could be conducted both in marriage and outside of it with much more freedom from fear than previously was the case. The extent to which it was responsible for the end of the baby boom is still a matter of dispute among demographers. It didn't become available until the early 1960s. The baby boom, this unlooked for expansion of the birth rate after the Second World War in most of the western part of the developed world anyway, did reach its peak in the 1960s and started to decline around the time that the pill started to become available. This is claimed by some demographers to be in part a consequence of the availability of this wonderful, convenient, safe, nearly invisible form of contraception. On the other hand, there are other powerful reasons why the birth rate started to go down in the late 60s and why the baby boom came to an end, to do with the movement of women into the workforce, to do with motivations for developing a career, for moving into higher education, which motivated women to reduce their fertility and postpone it, irrespective, if you like, of whatever method they were actually using to achieve that end.
David Coleman there on the controversial role of the pill on population. Fred, David was sort of describing a bit of a knotty problem when it came to the pill. Why is it not so clear that the pill, which is meant to stop new babies coming along, has not been the break that we might have thought?
Well, there have been a number of breaks. I mean, the pill is not the dominant technology that people use around the world to control their fertility. And I might say most women now around the world who are sexually active and fertile do use some form of contraception. That's a new point in history. Many more women use sterilization or other techniques. Some are safer and some are more dangerous, but women are, I think the real story is that women are choosing the size of their families, and they're doing it to suit their own needs. And the other big change that's happened in the 20th century is that today most kids get to grow up. It's for the first time in history now that most kids get to grow up. So women don't have to have 5 or 6 children in order to secure the next generation. 2 or 3 is usually enough. And increasingly, that's what women are doing. So today, the average woman around the world has 2.5 children. Now, that's only half as many as her mother and grandmother had on average. So there's a huge kind of reproductive revolution going on around the world, and that's why. And that's why I think that we are defusing the population bomb. It's not a matter of government policies so much as choices made by the women and, of course, their partners, but the women of the world.
I mean, the choices made by governments in the 20th century, the attempts to control population, have been disastrous.
Well, they've had been the more divisive ones have had huge backlashes. So the sterilization programs in India in the 1970s, for instance, put back the cause of contraception and family planning. And of course, what's been going on in China is the one-child policy, enforced policy, has been socially very destructive, I think. But really, mostly around the world, women are making the choices for themselves. It's not that there are large numbers of government population control programs going on. The ones that were there have mostly failed and shriveled away. This is, you know, choices that people are making freely. And I think that's a really, that's a good news story. We don't have to control population. What we have to do is provide the contraceptive services that people want and allow them to have the size of families that they want.
And education as well.
Education certainly helps. Urbanization helps. Once people move into cities, children are not an economic asset in the way that they are if you're on a peasant farm. You know, a three-year-old can look after the goats. It's quite handy to have around. You know, once you get into the city, kids have to get educated and so on. So once people move into the cities, they have fewer people. But really, it's a global phenomenon. It's just happening everywhere.
Well, medical research has also been a clear help in increasing population in the past century. New drugs, new understandings of disease, all of that has helped. Understanding our genes will no doubt continue to help us in the future. Here's Professor Timothy Dyson again on a relatively recent disease and its effects on population and medical science.
HIV/AIDS is often referred to as a new disease. It has gone on to do very severe destruction, particularly in eastern and southern Africa, and to lesser degrees elsewhere in the world. Life expectation at birth declined very considerably in many African countries. However, it appears that at least at the aggregate level, we're beginning to turn the tide, and death rates are gradually beginning to improve. So there is some hope so far as HIV/AIDS is concerned, although, of course, unfortunately, it is killed many millions of people.
Timothy Dyson there on HIV and the achievements of science in turning the tide on the disease. Well, sort of turning the tide. Fred, again, disease, medical science, these are two things that are constantly battling each other, in a sense. What's been the role of that overall in population? I mean, we've been getting better at curing things, but also new things come along.
Yes, they do, but life expectancy is continuing to increase. Now, there have been a number of countries in Africa where that stopped, especially during the height of the HIV infection rates. You know, in a number of African countries, a very large number of children don't reach adulthood. And that pushes up, if you like, the number of children that people have to have in order to ensure the next generation. But by and large, we've made good progress. As I was saying earlier, for the first time in history, most children get to grow up, and that is a result of medical advances over the last couple of centuries and has transformed the lives of women around the world. Because after all, if women are not can expect to live to be, say, 60 or 70 or even more, and if they don't have to have five or six children to ensure the next generation, it absolutely transforms the life of billions of women now around the world. They can have two or three children. They can get sterilized, the form of contraceptive of choice in most of the developing world, and get on with new lives, get on with doing new things, contributing more to society. It's a fantastically transformative thing going on here. And I think the reproductive revolution and the feminist revolution have gone together.
I mean, this also implies a change in the demographics of the world in terms of shifting the younger population to places like Africa, China, etc.
Yes, the 20th century really was a century of the young, the baby boom generation and so on. The average age of the world's population is very young. What we're going to see in the 21st century as families get smaller and people live longer is aging. Now, my sense is that if the big demographic story of the 20th century was population growth, population quadrupled during the century. The big demographic story of the 21st century is going to be global aging, not just in the rich world, but in the poor world as well. China is very soon going to be the country aging fastest of anywhere in the world. And that raises really interesting questions. What will our society be like if for the first time in history, most people are beyond middle age or middle aged and beyond? It's going to be a very different kind of society. I don't think we really know the answer to that.
And with very different economic impacts. I mean, if everyone is elderly, so to speak, who's making the money and paying for all the infrastructure and all of that?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not a pessimist about this, but it certainly will change things a lot. We can see, especially in Asia in the last half century, how countries where their economies have really been growing very fast are countries where the great majority of the population is young adults. There aren't many old people yet, and the young adults are not having many children. They've reduced their family size. And it's at that point a kind of demographic sweet spot where economies really grow very fast. But of course, that only goes on for a while. And we're now seeing Japan economy flatlining, having been the poster child of the tiger economies. Other countries going through that same phase, Korea and Singapore and Taiwan and so on. China is now is going to start aging very fast soon. What will that mean for China's economy? I think that's a very interesting question. And all through the world, I think we're going to see this. Now, of course, economies don't always grow if you've got a large number of young adults. If you don't employ them, then they can they can become terrorists or. But maybe I'm quite keen on the idea that the Arab Spring in this last year was partly a demographic phenomenon, because there are lots of young adults in countries like Egypt and Tunisia who are not at home looking after the babies because they're not having so many babies. They're out on the street demanding revolution, demanding democracy.
So if they'd had babies like their forefathers, then the Arab Spring wouldn't have happened.
That's my theory. I mean, I can't prove that, but it seems. What I would say is that I'm absolutely certain that young adults are a really dynamic force in a society, and it can manifest itself in different ways. But that then raises the question: what happens when you don't have many young adults? What happens to a society then? You can be optimistic and say it becomes sort of more relaxed, less consumerist, wiser, maybe perhaps even greener. But, we might just all sort of shrivel up and die. And we don't know the answer to that because we've never been there.
You mentioned Japan just a moment ago, and that's the population there has been sort of going the other way for in terms of aging and not having the replacements since the early 1990s. And its economy is also has been flatlining since then.
That's right. They had in the 1990s, they had what they call the missing decade.
Yeah.
And many people in Japan put that down to the aging population.
Is that what you think is going to happen to a lot of the Western world then?
Yes, I think it could. Now, it doesn't have to be such a disastrous thing if you don't have more people, you don't necessarily need your economy to grow. But I think we have to be much smarter about what we do with our economies at a time of minimal economic growth. We're going to be thinking about that over the next few years right now, and the sort of demographic background to that of aging. As I say, I don't think we know how that's going to play out. I have a secret hope that we might become older and wiser and greener, and that we might learn how to live a more sustainable lifestyle. But, maybe that's just me. I'm 59 now. Maybe I'm just having a rosy-tinted idea of what it might be like to be old.
I wouldn't make too many predictions. You know what that did for Malthus.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We're going to look ahead now. One thing that will cause a dramatic shift in population is climate change. It's going to have effects on everything from our ability to produce food to the spread of pests and diseases as temperatures rise. This is Professor Timothy Dyson again on The Coming Changes.
If there's a sudden shift in the world's climate, which could happen, then I think there would be there's possibly going to be very considerable disaster. I had an email today from someone in Denmark who was suggesting that we might face something similar to the Black Death. Now, I don't want to be too gloomy, but the point is, if there's a sudden switch, major transformation of the world's climate, if the what are called the thermohaline circulation patterns in the ocean were to shut down, and it's not beyond the possibility, then the world's climate would change radically and suddenly, and there's absolutely no doubt that food supplies for the vast majority of the human population would be very severely affected. However, that is a if you like, a worst-case scenario, but unfortunately it's not something that we can entirely rule out.
Professor Timothy Dyson there on climate change and his speculation on a doomsday scenario for food supplies and disease. Fred, population and climate change, we've completely landed in your expert area now. what are the factors that sort of link the two? We mentioned food production, for example. Do the world's farms change in different places? Do some places become less attractive for farming, others better? What goes on?
In the short term, it looks like away from the tropics, agricultural output may increase, but in the tropics, where temperature is a major constraint or where there are big changes to rainfall patterns, I think, you know, rainfall is going to be a big issue here, then there may be reductions. Further out, it's harder to tell. I think we will probably adapt rather better than we sometimes imagine to changing climate. But I think the key word here that Tim mentioned was sudden. If we have sudden climate change, abrupt climate change, what do we do about that? He was talking about the thermohaline circulation switching off. Now, sitting in Europe, that may feel quite nice. It might shut down the Gulf Stream and cool us down as we're getting heated up by global warming. But over in Asia, the evidence is that if it shut down, it would shut down the Asian monsoon too. You know, that would be 3 billion people not getting the rain they need to grow their crops. That would obviously be a huge calamity. So I think the key concern in here is sudden, abrupt change, the kind of change that we wouldn't be able to adapt to.
But what does sudden and abrupt mean? Is it decades or are we talking 5 years?
Could be in 1 year. We do know that the thermohaline circulation has switched on and off in, it looks like, a single year, certainly within a decade, and that was happening the end of the last ice age, when really very abrupt changes happen. What we do know about the history of climate change, natural climate change, is that it normally happens suddenly. It doesn't happen gradually. And the real concern here is that now humans are pulling at the same levers that cause natural climate change, that we too could cause very abrupt change.
What's the evidence actually that the thermohaline circulation is slowing or might shut down?
Not much good evidence that it's slowing at the minute. We scientists really don't yet know the level of natural variability in it, so it's quite difficult to predict. But it does depend on the formation of very saline water in the North Atlantic, which plunges to the bottom of the ocean because it's denser than the surrounding water and drives this global ocean circulation system. And the formation of that saline water depends on the freezing of water, the creation of ice, because ice is fresh water and it leaves the salt behind, and what the water that remains becomes more saline. So if you don't have ice forming, or if you have much more water, fresh water flowing off the continents to dilute the saline seawater, then there's a reasonable suggestion that might shut down the circulation. It is speculation, and I don't think anybody is suggesting that it's imminent, but it is a real possibility.
So food production is something that will obviously be affected one way or another. Is there anything else that sort of strikes out as a consequence of climate change, sudden or even gradual over the next century?
I think the two things that we really need to be concerned about are one, changing climate, not just temperature. I think probably we could cope with an extra degree or so of temperature, but big changes in weather patterns, weather systems, where it rains. One of the kind of most likely outcomes of climate change is that wet areas get wetter and the dry areas get drier. So that's going to create quite a lot of problems for quite a lot of people, both through droughts and also through floods. You combine that with rising sea levels, and quite large areas are the most fertile areas of the planet, and the most densely populated areas of the planet could simply flood. So I think those are the two dominant issues. And of course, how fast sea level rise depends very much on what happens to the big ice sheets.
Just finally on population again. In your book, People Quake, which came out last year, I think you were. You highlighted a lot of these problems about changing populations, demographics and things. But you were very optimistic about what population is going to do in the future. So it might go, you say it's going to crash at some point, or at least steadily go down
in the next century or so. I think that's quite likely. I think, as you know, family sizes are now half what they were a generation or so ago. This is a global trend. I think it will continue. I think most countries are likely to become like we are in Europe now, with fertility rates way below replacement levels. In other words, women having only about 1.5 children each. That's the European average now. And if the rest of the world goes that way, then we're going to see peak population. I think that's a good thing. I look forward to peak population, perhaps in mid-century. But after that, we don't know, but it could be that a slow tail down of population numbers would be quite good, but a faster one could be very dangerous, not least because of the aging issues we've been talking about. So it's a rather guarded optimism. I do look forward to peak population, but what happens the other side could be more dangerous.
Is that actually happening, though? Is the replacement rate in places like Africa and things, they're going down, and you think they might get to 2 or 1.5?
No. Well, as I say, we've come down to 2.5, which is a long way from where we were. Half the world, or nearly half the world, now lives in countries where the fertility rate is below or at replacement levels. So very large areas of Asia. If you go to Vietnam, you go to Burma, you go to Thailand, you go to Iran. That's really interesting. You know, hardline Muslim country, and yet fertility rates below 2 children per woman. So it's further behind in Africa. Africa is a real lagger here, but most of the world now is at or close to replacement fertility in a good number of countries. An increasing number of countries are below that. And that's why I say that it is quite possible that by the end of this century, we'll be seeing falling population.
Well, let's see if you or the UN are right by the 2100. The UN claims it's going to be 10 billion by the end of the century. And if fertility remains high, however, it'll be 15 billion. So one of you is going to be right. Thanks so much, Fred, there. To read Fred's work on this topic and to delve into our very snazzy, that's the technical word, by the way, snazzy, interactive history of population, just go to guardian.co.uk/environment. As this planet gets a lot more crowded, more than a few of you might have looked up into the night sky and wondered, is there a cheap semi-detached house out there with my name on it? Perhaps with a garden? With such cosmological thoughts in mind, London-based The School of Life invited Lawrence Krauss, a leading American theoretical physicist and director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University, to discuss our place in the cosmos. Here's the first of three parts of Professor Krauss's brilliant presentation.
First of all, it's a beautiful day in London. I don't know what the hell you're doing inside. And I also have to say that I was listening to the introduction, and now I realize I'm here under false pretenses, because I thought this was an event where you're supposed to talk about virtues you can avoid and vices you can live by. But in any case. Well, thank you for coming, and it's a pleasure to be here. It's a kind of surreal day for me and for many reasons, and we'll try and continue on that tack. Well, let's just begin. You're here because you want to escape reality. And that's one of the things that science is good for, to take us out at least beyond our petty worries and concerns of the day. And we all have them. So, we begin here. It's the best of times. And, of course, what do I mean by that? I mean that the Large Hadron Collider has turned on and in Geneva. And it hasn't created a black hole that would destroy the world yet. But at the same time, it's also the worst of times. We live in times that are full of violence and ridiculous hatreds, many spurred by religion, I have to say. And what I want to try and do is not only take you to new connections, but to take you beyond this brief moment in cosmic history to realize that all of this isn't important, that the really important stuff is far grander, and when next time you're depressed, you can think about the fact that we're really, in fact, completely insignificant. And the two messages I guess I want to give you, although I'm not sure if I'll get them both covered, is that first, you are much more insignificant than you thought, and secondly, that the future is miserable. Okay, but in any case, so. I began my own journey thinking about cosmic connections a while ago, when actually it caused me to write a book, when I was in one of my favorite places in the world, which is the Rodin Museum in Paris. And I love Rodin sculptures because they're kind of unique. Most sculptures are finished works of art, apparently. But Rodin sculptures always have this this connection between the original marble and the forms that came out of it. And so there's this beautiful transition from formlessness to form that you can see in pretty well almost all of his sculptures. And I started to think about that transition from formlessness to form one day when I was there. And then I looked at one of my favorite sculptures, which is called The Kiss, which many of you know. It's an immortalized kiss. And I started to think, well, it's immortalized. It's there forever. But, of course, it's not there forever, and it hasn't been there forever. The marble from which it was sculpted was only been here for maybe tens or 100 million years, and it would certainly not survive into the infinite future. So I started to try and think, what really has the possibility of eternal life, and how are we connected to it? And so that's the first cosmic connection I want to talk to you about. I want to talk to you about, as it's clearly written, the fact that we're all stardust, which is indeed the most poetic thing I know about the world. First, I want to begin with a pleasant thought. So this was the first high thermonuclear explosion in 1952 at 7:59 a.m. This was the hydrogen bomb Mike, the first time we exploded a hydrogen bomb on Earth. We destroyed a Pacific atoll in the process in a little over a microsecond. But during that brief instant, this wasn't created as a scientific experiment. It wasn't created to learn something and to create things. It was created to destroy things, unfortunately, like all such weapons. But it nevertheless did allow us to do something. During that brief instant when that bomb destroyed all living things on that island, it also created every element that's ever been created in the history of the universe. And that is what I want to talk a little bit about. This is one of my favorite Hubble Space Telescope pictures. Actually, they're all my favorite Hubble Space Telescope pictures. I love them all. But this is a galaxy far, far away, long, long ago. And not that far away. It's only about 50 million light years away. So it took the light just 50 million years to get from there to here, which in a cosmic sense is not very long. But it's a beautiful spiral galaxy, much like our own. Once you've seen one, you've seen them all, more or less. And if this were our galaxy, we'd be located sort of there in a boring suburb. I don't refer to where we are right now, but to where the sun is around the galaxy, right on the edge of the galaxy. And each galaxy, like our own, contains about 100 billion stars, and there are about 100 billion galaxies in the observable universe, a nice symmetry. And each of them, as I say, contains many stars, and around those stars may be planets and civilizations and David Bowie's And in this case, that they're long, long ago. The light left this galaxy 50 million years ago in order to get to us today. And so many of the civilizations that might have existed in that galaxy could long be gone. And every time I look out at the cosmos, every time I look out at the night sky, I kind of think about that. But one of the interesting things about this particular galaxy, which contains 100 billion stars, the center of it contains about 10 billion stars. And you notice that there's a star here that is shining as brightly as the entire center of that galaxy. Now, what does that mean? Well, the first presumption is that it's really a star in our galaxy that got in the way of the picture, because that would explain it. But it's not true. It's really a star on the edge of that galaxy, shining as brightly as 10 billion stars. How could that be? Well, it's a star that's just exploded. A supernova, the most brilliant cosmic fireworks in the universe. When a star explodes, it shines briefly with a brightness of 10 billion stars. And by briefly, I mean for a period of about a month or so. Now, stellar explosions, happily for us, are kind of rare. Stars don't explode too often. They explode once per 100 years per galaxy. And that means, happily, that in our galaxy they're not that often. But happily, they do explode. Because, as I'll point out, if they didn't, we wouldn't be here. Now, we try and look, before I do that, I want to talk about how we can see these things. How do we catch a supernova? Because once per 100 years per galaxy is pretty rare. So we use these supernovae to study the universe. In fact, actually, this type of supernova was used, in fact, to study the universe in a way that the Nobel Prize this year was just awarded for the people who were looking at this type of supernovae to study the universe. But if it's once per 100 years per galaxy, how can we find them? Well, the answer is, and this is one of the most profoundly important things I want to remind you about the universe, is it's big and it's old, and therefore rare events happen all the time. That's really important because if there's another lesson in this vices and virtues thing that I can tell you, it's really that we all think that events that happen to us are significant. We ascribe significance to them. And in fact, most of them are accidents. And the hardest thing to do is convince yourself that what happens to you is just an accident. But it happens all the time in the universe. In fact, I wrote a book about Richard Feynman. I gather I'll be signing some of those books maybe. And he used to go up to people and he'd go up to them and he'd say, "You won't believe what happened to me today. You just won't believe what happened to me." And they'd say, "What?" And he'd say, "Absolutely nothing." Because, you know, you have these stupid dreams for years and years and nothing. And then one day you have a dream that a friend is going to break their arm, and the next day they break their leg, and you say, "Cosmic, you know." And the point is that rare events happen all the time because the universe is big and old. And supernovae are rare events. But if you were to go out tonight and get outside of London where you could see the stars and look out at the night sky and take one of your 20 pence pieces about and take a hole in your hand about the size of a 20 pence piece and hold it up to the night sky, finding a spot where there are no stars, where it's completely dark. If you took one of the largest telescopes we have on Earth and looked at that same place in the sky, you'd be able to see about 100,000 galaxies. Okay? And if you work it out once per 100 years per galaxy, if you can look at 100,000 galaxies on a given night, you'll see one or two stars explode that night. And that's what astronomers do. They apply for telescope time, and tonight we're going to see one or two stars explode. And they might see one, they might see three, they might see none, it might be cloudy. But in that way, we can actually study these objects. And here, by the way, is a little movie of a star exploding, just to see, we can watch it. We can watch this particular star explode, and we can measure its brightness and its colors, and it tells us what type of supernova it is. And the important thing, as I say, is that stars exploding are very violent. They're the most violent explosion almost in the universe. Stars, when they explode, emit in a few seconds an energy equivalent to what they've emitted for their entire lifetime. And they're catastrophic, but important. Because in our galaxy, which is about 12 billion years old, except in my country, in Arkansas and Ohio and a few other places, 12 billion years, once every 100 years per galaxy, if you work it out, 200 million stars have exploded in our galaxy during its lifetime. And some of them are pretty to see. Here's one of the most recent ones we saw explode. It was actually not in our galaxy. It was the most recent supernova explosion seen close to us. It was in the Large Magellanic Clouds, which you can't see from here, but you can see from Australia. And a little satellite galaxy. And that star exploded we saw it in 1987. It was called Supernova 1987A. It actually exploded 150,000 years earlier because it was 150,000 years away, and the light came to us as did particles called neutrinos come to us, which did not travel faster than light to get to us, in case any of you are wondering. Supernovae played an interesting role in human history. This is the Crab Nebula, which is the leftover of a stellar explosion, and it was a star that exploded around the Battle of Hastings, around that time here in England. And it would have been so bright that it was visible during the day when a star like that explodes close enough to the Earth, not to destroy it, but enough to be seen. It would have been seen during the day. And it's fascinating to me, and I wasn't going to talk about this, but then since I wasn't sure what I was going to talk about, I guess it doesn't matter. It's fascinating to me, a historical fact, which is appropriate to talk about on Sunday, maybe. It was bright enough to be seen during the day, but there's no record that it was ever seen in Europe. The only record we have, there's two records that I know of that this supernova was seen. One was in China, where the court astronomers and astrologers saw a guest star in the night sky, which portended wonderful things for the emperor, and they told the emperor. There's also a picture of it in a Navajo cave that people have interpreted to be that supernova in the southwest of the United States. But nowhere was there a written record of it in Europe, where it was clearly visible during the day. And one of the possible explanations of this, because it was in the year 1066, I think, was that it was pretty dangerous to suggest that there was something new in the sky in 1066, because the Bible said the sky was sort of the stars and this edifice were eternal and created by God and would be there forever. And I suspect it would be dangerous to point out that there was something new up there. And that's not, I don't know of the proof of that fact, but it is remarkable nevertheless that something prohibited people from ever writing about it, and there are no records, not even any church records of it. In any case, they're all over the place, and here's Supernova 1987A 20 years later, and I'll give you a close-up of it, because you can see that what happens when a supernova explodes, and when a supernova explodes, it's kind of an amazing event, because the core of a star, larger than the size of the Earth, containing almost a million times the mass of the Earth, collapses from the size of the Earth to the size of London in approximately 1 second. And then when it becomes so dense, it becomes one giant atomic nucleus. And at that point, it stiffens up. It can't collapse any further, and there's a shock. It stops collapsing, and a shock wave shoots out and shoots out the whole outer part of the star. And here, the outer part of the star, you can see being shot into space and lighting up, because when it goes out into space, space isn't empty. Space has lots of gas in it. And when the shock wave goes by, it compresses the gas. And when it compresses the gas, it triggers other star formation. So here's a region of the sky we can see now, which has recently had a supernova, and you see all these stars. These stars began to form because a supernova nearby compressed the gas, causing it to begin to collapse to form a star. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about the life history of a star for a moment to show you how you're connected to the night sky. This is, you can't read this, but I can, which is what matters. Stars burn, and the rate at which they burn depends upon how big they are. Our sun will last about 10 billion years. It's 4.5 billion years old now. It's halfway through its life. 10 billion, so it has another 5 billion years left, which, by the way, reminds me of the only real cosmology joke I know, so I'll tell it to you. So someone like me is talking to a group of people like you on a Sunday, and he says, you know, the sun is going to burn for only for 5 billion more years. And someone in the audience goes, did you say 5 million years? And the speaker says, no, 5 billion years. And the guy goes, whew, okay. Anyway, so when a star 10 times the mass of our sun, however, is burning, it burns much faster, and it lives not 10 billion years, but only 10 million years, which is important. It's really important for us that big stars have short lives. And what happens when they do that? Well, stars are burning hydrogen fuel, just like our nuclear bomb did, turning it into helium. And when they do, they emit, each time some hydrogen atom nuclei come together to form helium, they emit over a million times more energy than you would get by lighting a match. The biggest bang for your buck, as my friends in Los Alamos say. And that means, and that's the process by which stars burn. And that all, since I'm in London, it also reminds me of another important story, I guess, is that people didn't know how stars burned. What was the power source behind stars was a big problem. How long can they last? And one of the first calculations of how long stars should last was done by actually a German doctor, which is amazing that he did a calculation, in the 18th century. And he said, well, if the sun is a lump of coal, and you knew the mass of the sun, it's easy to determine the mass of the sun, a million times the mass of the Earth, how long would it be able to burn? And the brightness it's burning now. And the answer was remarkable. When you worked out, it was 10,000 years, which was perfectly biblical. It was exactly right. But of course, we later learned that the Earth was actually older, and it was a big problem. How could you have a process that could cause an object to burn for much longer? And two physicists, Lord Kelvin here and Helmholtz in Germany, did an independent calculation. They said, well, maybe as stuff collapses, gravity causes it to collapse and emit energy, and maybe gravity is powering a star. And they worked it out, and they found out gravity could power a star for not 10,000 years, but about 100 million years, which was great. But even then, we knew the Earth was older than 100 million years old. We knew it was billions of years old, and it was a problem. And in 1929, Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington, a very well-known British scientist and astronomer, wrote a book on the internal constitution of the stars, and he said, there has to be some new energy process, some new physics working inside the star. And everyone, you know, they scoffed at that idea because the sun isn't that hot. It's only a million degrees. And 10 million degrees in its center, which is not that hot. I live in Phoenix, and it's not really that hot. And it's hot enough that you could recreate those conditions in the laboratory even then in the 1920s, and people thought they understood all the physics at 10 million degrees. And he said there had to be something new, and everyone said no. And one of my favorite bits of scientific literature, if you read that book, it says, for those who don't think the interior of the sun is hot enough for new physical processes, go and find a hotter place. That was British for go to hell, Satan. In any case, it was learned in the 1940s that there was a process that was a new process, and that was nuclear reactions, causing helium, hydrogen to burn to helium. And as I say, in our sun, that will go on for 10 billion years. But in a big star, it only goes on for 10 million years. So all the hydrogen burns into helium in 10 million years. What happens then? The flame goes out, if you wish, not quite, but almost. And then gravity starts to work, contracting the star. But then it gets hotter and hotter, and eventually it turns out that helium can burn to carbon. It's a much less efficient process. It's kind of miraculous and it works. But all of the hydrogen burns to helium in 10 million years. But because the sun is hotter and it's less efficient, to keep the energy production up, all of the helium burns to carbon in 1 million years. Then what happens? Well, carbon's there. Okay? Again, the star starts to collapse because there's no more fuel. But then it heats up. Carbon starts to burn. Carbon starts to burn to form neon and nitrogen. And all of the carbon in the star burns in 100,000 years. Because again, it's less efficient a process. And you get to oxygen. And oxygen, again, starts to burn eventually. And all of the oxygen burns to silicon in 10,000 years. Because it's getting hotter and hotter and hotter, less efficient. And then, when all of the oxygen is burned to silicon, you're in the last day in the life of a star. Because remarkably, it is so hot at that point that all of the silicon in the center of the star, many thousands of times the mass of the Earth, burns to form iron in one day. And at that point, it's rapidly burning and struggling for existence, because once it's burned to form iron, it's on its last death throes. Because iron can't burn to form anything. Iron is the most tightly bound nucleus in nature. And so once that happens, there's no more fuel. And it's kind of like Wile E. Coyote. I don't know if you see it. It was a cartoon that I saw in the United States called The Roadrunner. He runs off the cliff and then suddenly realizes that there's no cliff there and he falls down. And that's exactly what happens to the star. When all the silicon is burned to iron, suddenly the star realizes there's no place left to go. And that interior of the star, which has been held up by the pressure of nuclear burning, collapses. And that whole collapse happens in 1 second. And when it happens then, it spews out, there's a shock wave, and the shock wave, like an onion, spews out all of the elements that were created during the life history of a star. The carbon, the nitrogen, the oxygen, the iron. And that's vitally important, because every atom in your body was once inside a star that exploded. In fact, as I said, and I think the quote is in there, the atoms in your left hand probably came from a different star than your right hand, because 200 million stars have exploded to create the elements that make up your body. Because in the Big Bang, only hydrogen, helium, and lithium were created. That's not important. Well, lithium may be important for some people in this room, but carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, all those other things are the stuff that we depend upon. And those weren't created at the beginning of the universe. The only place they were created were in the nuclear furnaces at the center of stars. And the only way they could get into your body was if the stars were kind enough to explode. So as I said, and I threw it in a throwaway line, but it's become a big line. Forget Jesus. Stars died so you'd be born today. Okay? And it's true. You are stardust. It is literally the most poetic thing I know about in all of science. You are star children. You would not be here. Just think about that. Every atom in your body has experienced, maybe more than once, the most violent explosion in the universe. They had to, because they couldn't have gotten into your bodies otherwise. And 5 billion years ago, a supernova exploded in our region of the galaxy, compressing gas, triggering the formation of our sun. And it was those elements that came from that supernova explosion, mixing with the gas in the solar neighborhood, that produced everything we see in this room, and all of the rocky planets and everything. You are connected to the cosmos in an intimate way, and your atoms have been around for billions of years, changing their form until 5 billion years ago. They came in together in the current form they have, and they haven't changed since then. And they're in your body. So that was the first cosmic connection. You are connected to the universe by your atoms.
For more information on the School of Life, check out their website, theschooloflife.com. Part two of that lecture will be on next week's show, but that's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.